from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. U.S.-led airstrikes pounded targets in Iraq Thursday and Friday. The raids also struck targets in Syria, centered on the key border town of Kobani. The strikes in Iraq, centered near Ramadi, Al-Qaim, Al-Assad, and Mosul, came on the anniversary of the beginning of U.S. military involvement in that country 24 years ago.
Just 2 hours ago, Allied air forces began an attack on military targets in Iraq and Kuwait. These attacks continue as I speak.
That was the voice of then-President George H.W. Bush 24 years ago this Friday, on January 16, 1991, as he announced the beginning of what came to be known as the Persian Gulf War. A dozen years later, the second President George Bush, invoking the threat of a potential mushroom cloud over New York City in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks, announced the beginning of a massive bombing campaign that came to be known as Operation Shock and Awe.
My fellow citizens, at this hour, American and coalition forces are in the early stages of military operations to disarm Iraq, to free its people, and to defend the world from grave danger. On my orders, coalition forces have begun striking selected targets of military importance to undermine Saddam Hussein's ability to wage war. These are opening stages of what will be a broad and concerted campaign.
24 years after the first President Bush began the bombing, Iraq lies devastated after a decade of sanctions and bombings that destroyed much of the country's infrastructure, followed by a decade of war and occupation. Iraqi casualties number in the millions. And U.S. military involvement continues as both President Barack Obama and British Prime Minister David Cameron acknowledged at a press conference in Washington Friday.
In Iraq, the UK is the second largest contributor to the anti-ISIL coalition. RAF aircraft have conducted over 100 strikes and will continue to play a leading role. We will deploy additional intelligence and surveillance assets to help Iraqi forces on the ground, and we will ensure they are better trained and equipped to counter explosive devices.
We reviewed our coalition's progress against ISIL. We are systematically taking out their fighters. We're destroying their infrastructure. We are putting them on the defensive and helping local forces in Iraq push these terrorists back.
President Obama had his own shock and awe moment nearly 4 years ago when, on March 19, 2011, he announced the bombing of Libya.
Today, I authorize the armed forces of the United States to begin a limited military action in Libya in support of an international effort to protect Libyan civilians. That action has now begun.
That bombing campaign continued until October of 2011. Nearly 4 years later, Libya also lies devastated, its infrastructure destroyed, a quarter of its population either dead or living as refugees outside the country, and as the UN reported Friday, at least a tenth of its remaining people still homeless and desperate. We have this report from Stephanie Castro at the United Nations.
An upsurge in fighting in Libya since the start of the year has forced people to flee their homes, with about 400,000 now displaced across the country, according to the UN Refugee Agency, UNHCR. The agency says that many of the people have had to flee for a fourth or fifth time as the conflict raged across several towns and cities in the east, including Benghazi. UNHCR says that in Benghazi alone, the authorities are reporting that approximately 90,000 people are unable to return home. William Splinder is the UNHCR spokesperson in Geneva.
The displacement has been centered around Benghazi, Derna, and near the Gulf of Sidra in Benjawad and Ras Lanuf. This is just one of the areas of Libya seeing people in mass flight. Across the country, we estimate that approximately 400,000 people are displaced. In addition, Libya is host to nearly 37,000 refugees and asylum seekers of different nationalities, whose humanitarian conditions are increasingly precarious.
Meanwhile, 2 days of talks hosted by the United Nations to resolve the conflict in Libya concluded in Geneva on Friday. Participants are reported to have expressed their unequivocal commitment to a united and democratic Libya governed by the rule of law and respect for human rights. The North African country has been embroiled in a crisis since Muammar Gaddafi was overthrown nearly 4 years ago. Stephanie Castro, United Nations.
Allegations that Israel committed war crimes against the Gaza Strip last year will be investigated by the International Criminal Court. In a statement Friday, prosecutors said they would begin a preliminary investigation into allegations that crimes were committed in the period after the most recent hostilities began on June 13th of last year, lasting 50 days, during which more than 2,100 Palestinians and 73 Israelis were killed. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon confirmed that the Palestinians will formally become an ICC member on April 1st at their request. That's a move strongly opposed by Israel and the United States. The decision to launch the preliminary probe was immediately condemned by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who called the decision scandalous, claiming the court had no jurisdiction over the Palestinian territories. Emmerich Rogier, chief of situation analysis at the ICC, said he hoped Israel would cooperate with the examination, despite not being a signatory to the ICC treaty known as the Rome Statute. He spoke with journalist Christina Silveiro about the background to the investigation, which he termed preliminary.
It is a decision that the prosecutor of the ICC, Fatou Ben Souda, has made on the basis, in particular, of the declaration of acceptance of ICC jurisdiction by the Palestinian government earlier this month, on the 1st of January. And it means that the office of the prosecutor will now gather information on alleged crimes committed in Palestine since the 30th of June 2014. In order to decide whether there is a basis to open a formal investigation.
And what exactly are the crimes that are to be examined or considered?
We will look at the alleged crimes committed by all parties, by all groups, in particular during the conflict of the last summer in Gaza in July and August. But that could be other allegations that we will look into. What is important to note is that the prosecutor and her office act in full independence and impartiality, so we can and we will look at allegations against all sides.
What is it that has prompted the prosecutor to open this inquiry?
As a matter of policy and practice, and also in accordance with the regulations of the Office of the Prosecutor, when we receive a declaration accepting the jurisdiction of the ICC by a state, the normal practice is to open a preliminary examination. So in that case, we will look into allegations back since June 2014.
And do you have a expected date for any results on this preliminary examination? When can we expect a result from the examination?
Well, there is no deadline set by the Rome Statute to complete a preliminary examination. Our experience is that preliminary examinations may last from a few months up to sometimes a few years. That depends on the number of parameters, including the situation on the ground, the cooperation we get from partners, the volume and the quality of information that we manage to gather. That also depends on the existence of proceedings at the national level. So each situation is unique. We always apply the same criteria and the same standards, but then there are a number of parameters that impact on the duration of it.
The initial inquiry could lead to war crime charges against Israel, whether relating to the recent Gaza war or its 47-year-long occupation of the West Bank and the occupation of Gaza from 1967 until 2005. The Palestinians seek the establishment of a state in the two territories. There were reports of raids across Europe against what officials called terrorist cells, with arrests in Belgium, Germany, and France of at least 20 people. We'll have more on that next week.
I knew that I could never again raise my voice against the violence of the oppressed in the ghettos without having first spoken clearly to the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today, my own government.
This past Thursday, the Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s actual birthday saw activists in New York City take the message into the subways and onto the trains. Press TV's Caleb Maupin was there.
Martin Luther King Jr. has been dead for many years and has become an iconic figure in U.S. history for his leadership of struggles against racism and segregation. As protests against police brutality continue to grow larger, many felt that it was necessary on King's 86th birthday to commemorate his contributions and put them in a modern context. Activists gathered near the African Burial Ground, a national monument located in Lower Manhattan. Monica Moorhead, an organizer of the protests, explained why so many people continue to admire King.
Dr. King was all about struggle. He was all about activism. He was all about connecting those issues, the economic issues, along and with the social issues. And we really feel if he was alive today, if he was allowed to turn 86 years old today, he would be with us today, standing in solidarity with the victims of police terror.
Larry Holmes, a leader of the People's Power Assembly, said the struggle for economic justice, which was King's central focus in the last 2 years of his life, remains highly relevant.
We need jobs and schools and health care and housing and services and a decent minimum wage, a living wage. We don't need the police as an answer to the social problems of young black and brown poor people.
Alexia Flippo, a student activist at Hunter College, says that despite the cold weather, the protests continue to grow larger, and she anticipates bigger demonstrations in the spring and summer.
Absolutely no way that these protests are dying down. And for anyone who thinks they are, that means they're not on the streets, because we're getting stronger every day. And when the summer comes, we're shutting it down.
As protesters laid flowers at the African burial ground, they were monitored by a crowd of roughly 50 police officers. Protesters said they are planning many acts of disruption and civil disobedience in the lead up to the national holiday commemorating Dr. King on Monday. Caleb Maupin, Press TV, New York.
As we reported earlier, last week saw major developments at the 33-nation-strong CELAC summit in Beijing, with Chinese government and business elites discussing deeper economic, social, and strategic integration. But the close last week of that conference hasn't slowed further progress, as Venezuela's President Nicolas Maduro met in Moscow with President Vladimir Putin, and a senior delegation from the Russian parliament visited Nicaragua, among other developments. For more, we go to our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo.
I think his visit finished either yesterday or early today.
Right, Maduro's.
Because it was the last leg of a tour that he was making following the CELAC China summit in Beijing.
Right.
And after that summit, he went to visit other OPEC countries, because Venezuela is a member of the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries, mm-hmm. OPEC.
Right, an important member too. Yeah.
Yeah, and it's one of the most important oil derivative suppliers to the United States, isn't it?
Yep, that's right.
He went to Qatar and Saudi Arabia to discuss the current dramatic drop in the international oil price. And subsequently he went to Algeria, which is another very important OPEC member and perhaps more ideologically sympathetic to Venezuela than Saudi Arabia or Qatar might be.
Yeah, for sure.
And after that, he went to Moscow. And now Russia isn't a member of OPEC. I think Russia just has observer status in the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries.
But they're a player. They're a major player.
Yeah, and they're a huge exporter. I can't remember if they're second or third after Saudi Arabia or whatever. And of course those meetings were very important from the point of view of Venezuela, because unless I'm mistaken, the break even price for Venezuela is something around $60 US for their oil production. And currently, and what's the price today? Is it down around $45, something like that?
I think it was $2.38 about an hour ago. It's really dropping fast.
Yeah, and it is. There's
45.
There's something very, very weird going on in the commodity markets, which I don't think is merely explicable by the long-standing economic downturn that the major world economies have been suffering over the last. Well, ever since 2008, really.
Right, that's right.
In the United States, periodically, they'll start talking about green shoots and the recovery and stuff like that. But and for ordinary people, there's never been a recovery since 2008.
That's right. I know that for a fact. They're still at home typing on Facebook all day, the couple of thousand of them that I know.
Right. So, yeah, and that's and at an international level, and for a lot of countries that are described as developing countries, most of whom export raw materials, and the effects of the economic recession since 2008 have been somewhat mitigated because demand from China in particular has managed to hold up commodity prices. But now it looks as though the world economy has reached a situation in which commodity prices generally are going down, and in particular the oil price. And that was what explains President Nicolas Maduro's visit to his fellow OPEC members and also to the Russian Federation. The interesting thing is that whereas Qatar and Saudi Arabia had nothing much to offer in terms of measures that might mitigate the negative effects of the fall in the oil price for OPEC members like Venezuela, he had a more positive response from President Bouteflika in Algeria and a much more positive response from President Putin.
Well, let's be clear about this. There's a reason for that. The whatever pain Venezuela, Algeria, and or Russia feel as a consequence of this decision basically by the U.S., Saudi Arabia, and Qatar to keep prices down where they are, to drive them down and keep them there, it's to inflict exactly that damage on those countries. It's not an unintended side effect by any means.
Yeah, and it's interesting that when was it that President Putin made that speech in which he said, well, we expect that the situation is going to be difficult for about a couple of years and then things will reverse? And that was about what? And was that his New Year's speech? I've forgotten.
It was around then.
One of his recent speeches. And so what Vladimir Putin and his colleagues are saying is, well, we've got our own fish to fry, and let the international economy and the speculators on Wall Street and the politically motivated strategists in the United States and their allied countries like Saudi Arabia and Qatar do what they like. We're going to proceed and develop our country whatever they decide to do. And what seems to have happened in this meeting with President Nicolas Maduro is that Russia has made very clear that Venezuela will get all the support necessary certainly from Russia, in order to assist it through this difficult period, which President Vladimir Putin estimates will last 2 years. Now, that's fundamental in terms of the integration effects, the regional integration effects that are underway in Latin America. And it backs up what China said very explicitly. Over the last week or so, there was a statement from the Chinese government that they would give Venezuela whatever support it needed, and they would give Russia whatever support it needed to cope with the current adverse international economic situation. So what that means is that maybe I'm wrong to think this, but I think that's a categorical end. And you can say that the beginning of 2015 has marked the categorical end to United States unipolar domination of the global economy and the global political situation. That's over. Definitively over now.
Yep. And that process has been driven largely, aside from the other objective measures that we can get into, by U.S. policy. We're back to the dynamic of isolating everyone in the room, and you end up being isolated. So, from the point of view of an economist in China, Russia, Venezuela, you know, elsewhere, Nicaragua, it's really exciting looking forward. Because you almost have like a clean slate, looking at the parts of the world that are outside of the empire, being able to develop and build an economy based on the actual material efficiencies that can be extracted from placing this here and that there and producing this in this way and that way, rather than the legacy and the property rights that encumber the decision-making process in the West. They can build a brand new world economy from a clean slate with tremendous resources to bring into that, human, natural, and financial, and start building a new world.
Yeah, and of course, for people in North America in particular, the question is, at what point will the United States government begin to recognize that this is the new dynamic, and either they adjust to it or they get left behind?
Yeah, or they declare, or they declare war.
Well, and that's I tend to be optimistic on that score because
I'm.
No, I can't imagine. I know that there are plenty of insane people among the policymakers and strategists in United States, the upper echelons of the United States. A bit like, what was the name of that character in Doctor Strangelove?
Yeah, right, Doctor Strangelove.
Well, no, I mean, there was that U.S. general, wasn't there? And and Peter Sellers with that kind of taking off Henry Kissinger.
Yep.
And it was. Anyway, the point is that there are also plenty of sane people in the upper echelons of the United States policymaking elites, and most people in the majority world regard. A global war as kind of a remote possibility. Certainly, they don't exclude the possibility, but most people, certainly here in Latin America, are treating that as an extremely remote possibility, and they're constantly working in diplomatic terms to encourage the United States to engage with them as equals in the same way that China and Russia do.
Right.
So, you know, and let's hope that their efforts pay off and that policy in the United States may slowly begin to change. We've seen some change in the recent decision to change the United States government's diplomatic relations with Cuba.
Mm.
And apparently today some of those measures come into effect.
Yeah.
So let's hope that's a harbinger for more positive developments over the next 2, 3, 4, 5 years. I mean, we'll see, won't we?
Well, okay, I'll hope. But I also think we should have a plan B.
Okay. And so another interesting reflection of this new reality, and certainly here in Nicaragua, was the visit this week by a very high-level delegation from the Russian Federation's National Parliament.
Mm-hmm.
And they were here for 2 or 3 days. And the president of the legislature, of the Russian legislature,
yeah, the Duma, yeah.
Yeah, and there. And she met with President Ortega, and they had a long meeting and confirmed that Russia has a very solid commitment to developing its bilateral relations with Nicaragua and also its regional multilateral relations with the rest of the countries of Central America and the Caribbean. So, and that's, you know, that that's another sign that, and the it's not a question of deprecating the potential role that the United States might play in the region. The United States has a very important role to play in the region, both economically and politically.
For sure.
But at the moment, because its policies are so counterproductive, it's created a situation in which, and unhelpful, perhaps unhelpful is the most useful adjective to use, because what Central American and Latin American countries in general are doing is they're finding that it's more helpful to them and more useful to them to develop good bilateral relations with the Russian Federation and with China than it is to try and resurrect and transform the very problematic relations that they've always had with the United States over the last century.
Well, I mean, first of all, you don't see Russia and China interfering in the internal affairs of any countries in this hemisphere. And actually, you'd be hard-pressed to find a country in which China is interfering in the internal affairs anywhere on the planet, and Russia anywhere that doesn't directly open its territory to invasion. So that it's not just the models, but the actual, like the essence of the entities that we're talking about that's the problem. The legacy of U.S. Relations with Latin America would be heavy enough if they did a complete turnaround in policy, but they're not even rhetorically doing a turnaround in policy yet.
Right. Yeah, and you can see that in the way that, for example, Ecuador, I think today Ecuador is today or yesterday, Ecuador is celebrating 8 years of its what they call their Revolución Ciudadana, this kind of complete break with the previous political system, which is very similar to the United States system, a kind of two-party dominated system, which essentially meant a single-party system because both parties supported and promoted the same kinds of social and economic measures, broadly speaking. And that's changed over the last 8 years under President Rafael Correa, and his approval ratings are stratospheric. They're something like 80% or something ridiculous like that.
They love him.
And so, there's that. And then, I think that's an indication that, because Ecuador is a member of the Bolivarian Alliance of the Americas, this very progressive block of countries. Some people might dispute whether they can be called socialist or not, but they regard themselves as following the path of inspired by socialism, at least. Mm-hmm. And all of those countries, Ecuador, Venezuela, Bolivia, Nicaragua, perhaps not so much the small Caribbean island nations that make up ALBA, but certainly those main continental countries in Latin America, they've all developed very good bilateral relations with China and Russia. And Ecuador has recently announced after the CELAC-China summit in Beijing that it is formally developing what it regards as a strategic economic relationship with China. So, and perhaps Nicaragua, although it's a very small country, just 6 million people, and Nicaragua in some ways is kind of an exemplary case in looking at the world from that new changing perspective. Because, for example, China is investing effectively. It may not formally be the Chinese government, but the Chinese government is very, very directly supporting the investment involved in the construction of the Interoceanic Canal that has already started work here in Nicaragua.
Right.
And oddly enough, Nicaragua doesn't enjoy direct diplomatic relations with the People's Republic of China.
Really?
because it has a strong relationship with Taiwan.
Right, which is a legacy, but there's economic relationships, very close economic relationships, yes.
Yeah, and Daniel Ortega's position, and he said this many years ago, actually, something like 5 or 6 years ago, when then ambassador for Taiwan was returning to his country, and a new ambassador was going to be sent. And when he was saying goodbye to that ambassador at Taiwan, what Daniel Ortega said was that it was inevitable that as the economic situation in the world changed, the historical legacy of conflicts that have dogged international relations since the end of the Second World War is bound to change, and that he foresaw that there'd be some kind of resolution of the conflict between Taiwan and the People's Republic of China.
Right. Yes,
yeah, and he said that he was actively working for that, and I think the canal is you know, and that's just a footnote to all the massive implications of the Interoceanic Canal.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.